All right, I will call this hearing of the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee to order. Today is March 22nd, 2024. We do have a quorum. Happy first and second deadline day to all. First item on the agenda is approval of the minutes from March 21st. Representative Kern, will you move the minutes from March 21st?
So moved, Chair.
All right, any discussion of the minutes? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. First up, we've got Representative Hollins. I will move House File 4558 to be placed on the General Register, and I understand we have a DE2 to get the bill in the shape you would like. So I will also move the DE2. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Hollins, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Chair Beckerfin. Thank you, committee members. Very happy to be here on this early morning. These 8:30 committee hearings are like no joke.
We do this like every day, Representative Hollins. So no.
You all are stronger than I am. I'm very happy to be here to present House File 4558. This bill reflects extensive work with stakeholders, primarily the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association and a third-party billing company that I struggle to pronounce, so I'm not even going to try. To the best of our knowledge, there is no opposition to the bill. This bill seeks to solve a problem where there is disparity of treatment and problems that have arisen for tenants who live in a shared meter building. So tenants who live in directly connected buildings get their utilities directly from the regulated utility and are customers of those utilities with all the protections that are available under state statute, rules, tariffs, ordinance, bylaws, and longstanding utility doctrine. So think like the cold weather rule, those sorts of things that protect individuals. Tenants who live in a shared meter building have none of those protections. In this setting, tenants are not customers of the regulated utility company and get their utilities passed through by an intermediary, the housing provider, and sometimes even a fourth player, a third-party billing company. The Public Utilities Commission, the Attorney General, the Department of Commerce, the utility companies, and tenant advocates have all been getting complaints about issues involving billing service, disconnection, and eviction in these shared metered buildings. So this bill puts tenants in these shared meter buildings on the same footing as tenants in direct meter buildings and gives them all the protections that a regulated utility customer has, including protections against utility shutoff in the winter, fairness in billing, and access to the PUC's complaint handling staff. This bill also makes sure that the metered electricity are accurate, and ensures that charges to tenants, whether they're through submetering of electricity or apportionment of gas and water, reflect only what the tenant uses and only their pro rata portion of fixed costs. One important compromise with stakeholders that deserves a mention is the bill before you allows housing providers or third-party billers to impose a billing fee per billing period, which is equivalent to what a customer who is connected directly through to Xcel or CenterPoint would pay for their monthly service charges. The bill also makes clear that tenants do not pay for common usage or spaces occupied by the housing provider or property manager. And it prohibits utility service disconnection but allows the housing provider to take an action for breach if the utility bill is not paid. There's a number of supporters on the bill and a number of stakeholders that we've worked with. Supporters include the AG's office, the Citizens Utility Board, Housing Justice Center, Student Legal Services, Minnesota Community Action Partnership, and Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans. And the stakeholders that were consulted during the process of the drafting and redrafting of this bill were the Minnesota Department of Commerce, Xcel Energy, CenterPoint Energy, Minnesota Power, Minnesota Rural Electric Association, Minnesota Municipal Electric Association, the Minnesota Modular Manufactured Home Park Association, and third-party billing companies. So I have several testifiers, and I would like to allow them to speak as well.
All right. First up, I've got Ron Elwood. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. First of all, I want to thank Representative Hollins for her work on this. And also, I know Ms. Davis is not feeling well, but she deserves an incredible shout out for the work she did here. And really want to appreciate her And I want to thank you, Madam Chair, for hearing the bill this year. So let me first say that the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association demands professionalism among their members and promotes the best practices in the industry. But this issue of utility billing and shared metered buildings has been percolating for a lot of years. The problems we have seen have increased dramatically with the entry of the third-party billing companies who do not have any contractual relationship with the tenant, and their entrance onto the scene has kind of precipitated this. As you've heard, the state agencies have been fielding complaints, but they have no jurisdiction and they really can't do anything, and thus they were unable to resolve all these complaints. The straw that broke the camel's back that brought us here today was last year when we had a client who was a tenant in a subsidized building. She had her rent paid up completely in full. She hadn't been billed for her utilities for 3 months and got a bill for $300 plus, which she couldn't pay. The third-party billing company in that instance shut off her electricity. And so we got together over the fall with all the parties that were mentioned here, including the PUC, the Attorney General's office, and all the utilities and the advocates and multi-housing and everybody else. Everyone at that meeting agreed that the system is broken and it needs to be fixed. And the third-party billing company, Sagility, with whom I want to thank them because we work with them too on this bill, they basically said regulate us. And they noted that states, other states, have similarly done something to create rules of the road in this area. So this bill fixes that broken system. And I'm really grateful to all the stakeholders, but especially to the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. We've worked long and hard. They worked in good faith and collaboratively with us to get to where we are today. So we're hopefully asking you to pass House File 4558. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And then I have Cecil Smith. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Cecil Smith. I'm the President and CEO of the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. I also want to thank the author, Representative Hollins, and Legal Aid. We have had some very robust conversations and good discussions. Business loves certainty and clarity, and this bill is bringing that to this area of our industry, which I'll be honest, we're not specialists in the area of utilities. We are housing providers. So we would urge passage of the bill.
Thank you. Is there anyone from the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right, not seeing any, we will move on to member discussion. Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you so much for bringing this bill. It is so important. I have talked with seniors in St. Anthony about this exact issue, and I'm just reminded how much of a team sport the legislature is. Yesterday, Representative Nash brought a bill about a really specific issue I talked with constituents about regarding mandatory reporters. And I had no idea, and then, like, here it was, a really good solution. And this was one of those bills, too. I do have a question. One of the issues that my constituents had raised was that in this very opaque, convoluted billing system, they would get billed for really confusing amounts for, like, future projected theoretical use. And I was wondering if this bill does anything to address that.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you. I'm mostly going to defer to Mr. Elwood in these situations, but that is one of the things that we've heard very consistently from individuals is that they are getting billing statements that just are not, like, comprehensible, and they don't understand what's happening, and that is one of the things that this bill does seek to ensure, that it's more like a billing statement that you would get from Excel when you have a single family home, that it's, like, clear and readable and understandable, and that you are literally being billed for the things that the space that you actually occupy. And I don't know if Mr. Elwood has anything to add to that.
Mr. Elwood.
Madam Chair and members, what Representative Holland said.
Very good. Anything else, Representative Feist? All right. Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Hollins, for taking on this issue. And I just wanted to say this is like the model of how these kind of discussions should come about, where we can find a shared goal and bring together stakeholders and figure out the right way that it actually has to be done. So thank you to all of you. And I've said this to you, Mr. Elwood, before privately, but I just wanted to say on the record that this is exactly what I've come to expect out of you in my experience with you at the legislature. So good work on this.
Representative Scott.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and thank you to all the stakeholders and Representative Hollins for working on this issue. There's a lot of moving parts and a lot of stakeholders involved. You know, you think of the utilities, but these third-party billing places are becoming more and more common. So thanks for your work on that. And I just want to know if anything in this bill addresses the issue of driving by a building that you own and the second story windows in February when it's sub-zero are open. and you're all on 1 meter. And it's like, oh, I know it's hot up there on the second floor, but no, thank you for your work on this bill and bringing it. Thank you.
All right. Closing comments, Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair Beckerfin. Thank you, committee members. I would love to say that I could do this without the help of Mr. Elwood, but there's absolutely no way that I could. And I deeply appreciate his engagement with all of the different stakeholders. And this has been a very long process, so I'd appreciate your support.
All right. With that, I will renew my motion to recommend that House Bill 4558, as amended, be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Hollins. Next up, Representative Byrd. Welcome to the committee. I will move to recommend that House File 4286 be placed on the general register. You do not have any author's amendments, so please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This is the Department of Labor and Industries policy bill. And so I'm just going to mention the two pieces of it that are germane to this committee. Section 1 updates 13.79 subdivision 1 to make the identity of any individuals complaining to the DLI under the covered chapters private data. Currently, the section only classifies the identities of employees making complaints as private. DLI often receives complaints from non-employees who also benefit from their identity being protected. Section 13 adds liquidated damages for minors working in hazardous occupations. Employers would not be liable for liquidated damages for smaller child labor violations, such as a minor working later than legally allowed, only for minors illegally employed doing hazardous work. So that's a high level of what seems to be in judiciary's jurisdiction. I believe I have a testifier who can help explain things.
All right, I've got Director Jessica Groves. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and members. My name is Jessica Groves, and I am the Director of the Labor Standards Division at the Department of Labor and Industry. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 4286, the Labor Standards Policy and Technical Bill. I will focus my testimony on briefly addressing the changes this bill makes that may be under this committee's jurisdiction. Section 1 classifies the identities of complainants as private data when individuals complain to DLI regarding alleged violations of Chapter 177, 181, 181A, or certain parts of Chapter 179. Sections 12 through 15 make changes and clarifications to child labor laws, including clarifying the existing penalty structure, establishing an anti-retaliation provision, and adding liquidated damages for minors working in hazardous occupations. I'll conclude by highlighting the importance of these child labor provisions in a time when child labor violations are rising in this country. Retaliation protections are necessary to ensure employees can file complaints and participate in investigations without fear of retaliation from their employer. Adding a liquidated damages provision would provide impacted minor children with a monetary remedy when employers require them to perform hazardous work in violation of the law and to the detriment of their safety. It would also deter employers from employing minor children to perform this hazardous work. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 4286.
All right, thank you. Are there other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right, not seeing any. We do have a pre-filed amendment. Representative Niska, I believe it's your amendment, the A5, if you would like to move that and then speak to your amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, the A5 amendment is my amendment, and it's really dealing just with one particular point in the bill, which, according to research, I think is the only instance where we would have in the Minnesota statute some government board where we have a restriction on who has to, which particular members of that board have to vote for something in order for it to move forward. And so on page 6, section 8, says that 2 of the 5 affirmative votes have to be cast by the commissioner members or their appointees. And I just was curious to hear from either the bill author or the testifier as to why that provision is in there, because it seems very, my understanding is it's completely unusual in the statute books, or would be, and seems odd to me. So I was curious to hear the rationale for it.
I'm guessing that's a one for Director Gross.
Thank you for your question. That amendment was added as an effort to support good governance.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And could you elaborate a little bit more on what you mean by good governance? I mean, we're talking about a board made up of industry and labor and then 3 government people. Why is it important that that we restrict who gets to vote what way on it for the board to take action?
Director Gross.
Sorry.
Thank you. Apologies. The department determined that a minimum number of votes by commissioner members would support good governance, and so determined that at least 2 of 5 affirmative votes would help to support the goal of good governance.
Representative Niska.
Thanks. I feel like I'm missing something in that about, yeah, that if we're going to make something, new, different standard from anywhere else in the board, I think it would behoove the department to say more than just the phrase good government or good governance over and over again. So I think that, I don't think there's been a rationale for adding an unusual, unprecedented provision. Maybe I could be persuaded otherwise if I could actually understand what the rationale was. But I don't think that they presented us as a legislature with a rationale for writing a new governance provision into the statutes that's nowhere else in the statutes. So I urge members to vote yes.
Representative Berg to the A5.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would recommend a no vote.
All right. Any further discussion to the A5 amendment? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Berg, this is obviously your bill. Why are you know, if I ask you the same question that Representative Niska asked the person here from your testifier, why would it, in your mind, be important that at least 2 of the 5 affirmative votes must be cast by the commissioner members or their appointees? Why would you put that, what's your rationale?
Representative Berg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My rationale is that this was discussed heavily within the department, and they agreed that this language made sense, and I support the department in this.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We just heard a bill that had lots of stakeholders that participated in coming up with the final bill language. Representative Berg, was that the case here? Were there other stakeholders that worked with the department to come up with this language?
Representative Berg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would imagine so. I'm not privy to those meetings, but thank you for the question.
All right. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would ask the testifier if there was a collaboration, and if so, who was involved in the collaboration on this language?
Director Gross.
Thank you for your question. I don't have that information available at this time, but I could gather that information.
Great. Anything further, Representative?
No.
All right. Representative Johnson.
All right, Chair Becker Finn, Representative Berg. I have real concerns on this. We're a constitutional republic, and we talk about democracy. Now you're diluting the votes of board members. That is not right, where you have two board members and one commissioner vote for something, but the minority can take it down. That's not democracy. I have real concerns where this is going and the precedence that is set. I would urge members to vote for this amendment because it's a real slippery slope we're heading down if we start doing this.
Closing comments on your amendment, Representative Niska.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And I offered this amendment to start a conversation. I actually kind of expected to withdraw the amendment. I expected to actually hear the administration tell us as a legislative branch why they want to change the statutes. This is where we as the legislative branch have to stand up and say, you have to, executive branch, if you want us to change the laws, you actually have to tell us the reasons why you want to do it. We heard from the testifier that there have been heavy discussions within the department about doing this, and they came to this conclusion. Representative Berg says she wasn't privy to those discussions, and they're not giving us the rationale for what those discussions are. I might be persuaded by those discussions if they were to share them with us, and maybe those on the other side of the table would be persuaded on it as well. But this is where we as a legislative branch have to stand up and say, coming to us with a statutory change, you as the administration have to actually give us the reasons, not just the word good governance over and over again. So to those of you who hold election certificates on the other side of the aisle, you should stand up for the legislative branch. Tell the executive branch that they actually have to provide a rationale before they just come to us and ask for change. So I encourage members to vote yes. And Madam Chair, I request a roll call.
All right. Roll call having been requested, the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker Finn.
No.
Vice Chair Frazier.
No.
Minority Lead Scott.
Aye.
Representative Carroll excused. Representative Curran.
No.
Representative Feist.
No.
Representative Finke.
No.
Representative Frederick.
No.
Representative Grossel.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Moeller.
No.
Representative Niska.
Yes.
Representative Weens.
Aye.
5 ayes, 7 nays.
All right, with 5 ayes and 7 nays, the motion does not prevail. Moving on to member discussion to the underlying bill. All right. Closing comments, Representative Berg.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee members. I appreciate the discussion. I believe in democracy. There has been a request for information from the agency, and I look forward to seeing that, and I look forward to you being able to look that over and feel comfortable with our decision today. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. With that, I renew my motion to recommend that House File 4286 be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Berg. Representative Frederick. This is no offense to you, Representative Frederick, but I don't know that I've ever moved a bill that's in the 5,000s.
ding, ding, ding.
I know there were 5,012 other bills that had to be introduced by other people first for us to get to that number, but I just realized as I was looking at this that I haven't had to do that before. So, Representative Frederick, would you like to move to place House File 5013 on the general register?
Yes, Madam Chair.
All right. We don't have any amendments, so please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My bill is about the Safe at Home program. And for those that aren't familiar, the Safe at Home program is and we've talked about it as a committee a little bit, but for those that aren't familiar, it's just a program designed for people who have safety concerns to be able to hide their address from the public space. And this bill seeks to do two things under that program. Current state law says that someone has to be a Minnesota resident before they can apply for that program. But if someone's coming to the state and needs to be part of that program, we're going to say you get a 60-day window to apply and then move to the state so you don't have to get here first, establish a public residency, and then apply for the program, because that seems to kind of defeat the purpose a little bit. The second part of the bill that's the substantive change is
I've been thinking about how to address this in committee because it addresses a safety concern within the program that would potentially lead to someone's address becoming public or known. And so we're trying to close that loophole. It doesn't affect the majority of the people who are in the Safe at Home program, but it does potentially impact a small number. And I believe that the Secretary of State's office has had conversations with both sides of the aisle on this. So I am more than happy to talk about the bill and that provision, but I also want to make sure that we're not saying in a very public space, if people do X, Y, and Z, then you'll know where someone's address is. So I would just ask for tactfulness as we have this conversation.
Yeah, appreciate that, Representative Frederick. I have Nicole Freeman signed up. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Frederick. Nicole Freeman, the Office of the Secretary of State. I'm here to talk to you today about House File 5013. So as the representative noted, Safe at Home is our state's address confidentiality program. It's a program for people with very high safety needs. In 2023, the program served over 5,000 participants. The Office's Safe at Home division, the staff members speak with current and prospective participants every day and work with public and private partners to ensure participants' data remains private. Those conversations bring us to this bill, which makes two policy changes, as the representative noted, and two technical changes. So sections 1, 2, and 3 all deal with, as the representative noted, allowing an individual to apply and become a participant if they intend to move to Minnesota within the next 60 days. Section 4 allows a person or an entity to send mail to an alternative mailing address rather than the Safe at Home PO box in limited circumstances. And sections 4 and 5 are the ones that make clarifying changes to address questions from stakeholders. I'll leave my testimony brief, but I'm happy to go into more detail if folks would like. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right, not seeing any, we'll move on to member discussion. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the conversations that we've had. And on the Safe at Home program, I think it's an excellent program. I wish every state had the equivalent of this. That would be, to me, a really excellent use of the Uniform Law Commission to come up mm-hmm. with this. So when we do have people moving here from other states, or as I've talked to you in the past, let's say somebody's coming here from out of state and they have a second home here, they have a lake home, and they want that address to be private as well. I just think there could be a lot of good done across the nation to protect those that are in fear. So I think this is a great first step, and I want to continue working on that issue of, I mean, we have a lot of people that come from out of state to a lake home or whatever, and so I would hope that they would eventually be protected as well. And I ask for member support. It's a good bill.
Thank you, Representative Scott. And as you know, I think that the Secretary of State's office and the Safe at Home folks have done a good job. You know, they almost every year they're coming with little tweaks and ways that we can improve this program. And I do appreciate the continued engagement on making sure this program functions the way that we all want it to. So closing comments, Representative Frederick.
It's a good bill. I just asked for the committee support. Thank you.
All right. Representative Frederick renews his motion to recommend that House File 5013 be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
We have
Representative Agbaje. I will move House File 685 before the committee. I will note that we are waiting on a fiscal note, so the plan is to lay this bill over until we have that fiscal note and can make an educated decision about what to do next. So, Representative Agbaje, I will move House File 685 before us. I understand you have an A1 amendment. Do you want to take care of that first?
Sure. We can do that right now, and then I'll talk about the whole bill together.
Got it. So I will move the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Agbaje, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. I'm here today to present House File 685. This bill offers a start at addressing the trend of corporate and investor owners in the housing market. The bill would limit corporate entities from buying single-family homes for the sole purpose of turning them into rentals. There are some exceptions to the limitations that are included in the bill. There's another one coming in a future amendment. But corporations that own less than 10 properties would be exempt from the provisions in this bill. Additional entities like nonprofits, trusts, builders, and then with a future amendment, we'll also be exempting another group, are also exempted from the provisions of this bill. And the new amendment also proposes two remedies, so a court would have a choice between them. So one remedy would either be a corporation would need to divest from its excess holdings. And for those properties that have tenants, those tenants would have the rights, the first right to purchase the property. Or the other remedy, which again would be at the choice of the court, the corporation would pay a fine on each excessive holding that would go into currently listed as the housing trust fund. Other corporations not listed in our list of exemptions can apply for an exemption from this prohibition if the exemption would not preclude the goal of owner-occupied home ownership. Currently, enforcement is written through the Attorney General's office, and Minnesota Housing would manage the exemption list. Since this bill will be laid over, we do have some time to continue to work out the finer details of tracking violations as well as the management of the enforcement. Overall, home ownership in Minnesota is something that continues to be out of reach, particularly for Minnesotans of color or working class Minnesotans. And the reasons are varied, but corporate ownership of single family homes is definitely a factor. According to reports from the Federal Reserve, Pew Charitable Trust, and reporting done by the Star Tribune and others, corporate entities are purchasing more homes in the marketplace to the detriment of many first-time home buyers. In fact, I receive emails every day from across the state of Minnesota that had a law like this been in place, those people would have been able to purchase a home. Minnesotans are asking for us to help them keep open a path to home ownership, and this bill is a proposal to do just that. Part of the reason why a bill like this is necessary to address the issue of corporate owners is because sometimes those owners can be absentee landlords who have limited property management oversight, and they do not address repairs and other issues in a timely fashion. Some stories we've heard show that the only time you hear from these types of corporate landlords is when the rent is due. And some of the most egregious issues were out of Havenbrook Homes, which the Attorney General's office sued them earlier last year. By limiting the amount of single-family homes that corporate entities can own, hopefully we can have more homeowners that are present in their communities. And that is the general purpose of this bill. The measure is meant to ensure that Minnesotans, wherever they are, know that they will be able to compete in a more even playing field to get an opportunity at home ownership. Home ownership builds wealth and opportunity for individuals and their future generations. So I hope that we can work together to create this opportunity to remove a variety of barriers to the American dream. With that, I think there's a couple of testifiers, and I'll look forward to questions after that. And of course, the amendment as well.
Yep. First up, I have Kristen Incity. And then on deck, I have Pat Paulson. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Yeah, thank you for having me. My name is Kristen Incity. I'm the CEO of Habitat for Humanity of Minnesota and the co-chair of the Homeownership Minnesota Coalition. Thank you, Chair Becker Finn, Vice Chair Frazier, members of the committee, and Representative Agbaje for the opportunity to testify today in support of House File 685. Homeownership Minnesota is a statewide coalition of nonprofit organizations dedicated to the production and preservation of affordable homeownership and to preparing households for homeownership. We are collectively motivated to advocate for policies and resources that advance our goal of closing the racial homeownership gap in Minnesota and increasing opportunities for low and moderate income households to affordably own homes in their communities. In 2021, the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis did a study to understand the investor activity in the Twin Cities, and they found that investor ownership of single-family homes has grown, and it has grown in a manner that shows intentional targeting of lower-income neighborhoods by investors. Nationally, investor ownership activity has doubled over the past few years. We see this activity in Greater Minnesota as well, especially in our beloved Lakes communities, in the Duluth area, and in Rochester, with the impact of medical tourism driving these purchases. Point being, this isn't only a metro challenge. It's impacting communities of all sizes across the state. The Federal Reserve study I mentioned also noted that this activity could cause a reduction in single-family ownership because there are fewer affordable units to purchase, and that ownership can then also be held by disengaged investors and have an impact on neighborhood character. It's important to note this issue in the context of an affordable housing supply shortage in Minnesota. Up for Growth, a national housing advocate group, estimates that Minnesota needs at least 95,000 more units to reach adequate housing supply. And other statistics we've heard is that this number is closer to 114,000. Additionally, data from Minnesota Housing Finance Research tells us that there are at least 61,000 households of color in Minnesota who can afford to buy a home but continue to rent, with one of the leading reasons for this being the lack of affordable homes to purchase in their communities. We risk continued loss and less equitable access to homeownership opportunities when affordable homes are converted into rentals by investors. The combination of extreme supply shortage with investor activity we're seeing in our communities warrants the state's involvement to slow the stream of affordable single-family homes for purchase being lost from the market in this way. Homeownership Minnesota sees this bill as a way to stem this trend. Additionally, we appreciate the fine-based approach being included in today's amendment and would suggest the resources accumulated through that process be designated to the Workforce and Affordable Homeownership Program, a program that Minnesota Housing supports that supports affordable homeownership program development statewide. Should ownership opportunities be lost through this market challenge, creating a revenue stream that supports ownership production to help replace that loss would be positive. Homeownership Minnesota supports House File 685 and looks forward to continuing to work on this bill and advancing this effort. Thank you for your time and leadership in this work.
Thank you for your testimony. So I have Pat Paulson and then I have Phil Roser on deck. All right, please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
I'm Pat Paulson, and I reside in Richfield. Chair Becker-Finn, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to speak on HF 685. I've been a realtor in the metro area for 38 years, and I'm also the 2024 treasurer of the Minnesota Realtors Association. While we appreciate efforts that attempt to support home ownership, we have concerns with HF 685 and its use of market restrictions. Restricting some buyers results in fewer sales. The buyers in this that this bill is attempting to help could be harmed when it's time to sell. I'm also concerned about financially distressed sellers whose only buyer may be an investor. That can happen even in the most extreme sellers' markets. Markets change. And we learned in the aftermath of the 2008 housing crash that when there are not enough buyers, too many single-family homes can go through foreclosure, sit vacant, and fall into disrepair. We've heard concerns raised about large institutional investors. However, the ownership threshold in this bill is 10 or more. That threshold will cover smaller local housing providers. The bill also requires owners who own more than 10 rental properties to divest of those properties within 2 years. This is a clear violation of private property rights and would also displace existing tenants. The bill also requires a notice period for divestment of properties and requires the sellers to disclose the price, terms, and conditions of an acceptable offer. This diminishes the rights of the seller in the negotiation process. There are ways to help buyers without hurting sellers, tenants, and small investors. Again, thank you for the opportunity to testify on HF 685, and we look forward to continuing to work with Representative Igbaje on these issues.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Next up, I have Phil Rosarg. And then are there any other members of the public wishing to testify? All right, please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you for letting me speak here. My name is Phil Rosar. I am one of those corporate people you're trying to get rid of. I am an investor who has been in this market. You never heard of me because I'm also a very good landlord. I have zero work orders on my properties. I have zero vacancies. I rent below Section 8. standards. Most of my rentals are substantially below Section 8. This bill, the way it's put together, is not, I understand what you're trying to do is get rid of the corporate people who are bad players in the marketplace, and I'm for that. But this bill is not aiming a bullet at those people. It's napalm taking everybody out. It's non-discretionary. I have tenants that have rented from me for 20 years. I would have to displace some of those tenants. They have no place to go. They have not the ability to own a home. This bill will then put those people on the street. And it's interesting, a couple of things. I was asked by the city of Coon Rapids, the Economic Development Commission, because I owned industrial property, to provide reasonably priced housing in that area so that the workers would have a place to live. I took some of those properties on and subsidized them myself. No government help here. I did it myself. The city of Blaine, the planning commission asked me to do the same there because they saw what was going on in Coon Rapids. Do I have to quit?
If you could wrap up.
In short, I'm not against the bill but I am against the way it's written, and I don't think there's been any thought given to the ramifications, the collateral damage to renters, especially renters. With me, I'm at the winter of my life. I'm going to start divesting. In fact, I already have. The other thing is, this is a taking. When you're being forced to sell something, it's a taking. So you're going to take our property from us, which I work for, and then tax me for it on capital gains. I think there should be some easing of the capital gains tax. For me, it will be horrendous.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. We do have a pre-filed amendment from, I believe, Representative Scott. Would you like to move the A2 and then speak to it?
Yes, Madam Chair, and spoke with Representative Bajay on the House floor yesterday, and about this amendment, I was receiving some phone calls about employers that provide housing to their seasonal workers and that sort of thing, and they would be hooked into this bill language and would no longer be able to provide that housing for their seasonal employees. So this would just just insert on line page 2, line 10, that an employer who provides housing for use by their employees would be exempt from the language, the rest of the language of the bill, and I'd ask for member support.
Representative Agbaji.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Scott. She actually beat me to putting this amendment into the bill. So, yes, I've heard the same concerns from different industries about those who do provide housing for their employees, and I think that's something that we should exempt for now, and then we'll continue working on what fuller exemptions look like. So, thank you. I encourage member support.
Representative Feist, to the amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was looking at this amendment, and I was wondering if you want to clarify that this would exempt this, or maybe this does. Maybe I'm just misunderstanding it. But this isn't just saying that if they provide any house for use by their employees, it's saying that they would be exempt in the purchase of a specific property when it is for that use. And so the way this is written covers that. I was just thinking any company could then buy a random house and then buy lots of property and say, well, this other house that we own is used by employees, so we're exempt from the whole bill. And so I just wanted to make sure that wasn't how this would work.
Yeah, Representative Bajay, but we are laying the bill over, okay. So there's time to, if
yeah.
That's a legitimate concern. I'm not sure, Representative Agbaji.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Feist, for bringing that up. I think what I want to do now is just to be able to signal that the intention is to exempt employers who are providing housing specifically for their employees. But since this bill is being laid over, we'll figure out the best way to, you know, fine-tune that language along with other language. But for right now, I think this is just a good step to know that
that's what we want to do. So, all right. Closing comments on your amendment, Representative Scott. All right. Representative Scott renews her motion on the A2 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Moving on to member discussion to the bill as amended. Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. And I just wanted to say thank you, Representative Agbaje, for your work on this bill and related bills. I know we've been having a lot of conversations about affordable housing in all of our communities across the state, and I think this is one way to address the issue, along with a set of other bills that I think will bring us in the right direction. And I just wanted to point out that I know in recent conversations in my community, folks are talking about, you know, how they wouldn't be able to afford the home that they live in today if they were to come into the community and have to purchase it as a new homeowner. And I think this bill starts to address that very issue, where we really want to see single family residential areas meant to be for families and not corporations. And, you know, part of that is pricing folks out who might be able to have permanent residency in our communities and who are looking for a new community to call home. And so I just appreciate your work on this, and I support it. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker-Finn, Representative Badgey. As you know, in the Housing Committee, I have a lot of heartburn over this bill. Back during the housing bubble burst, it was under the Obama administration that actually asked people to start buying these homes, these blighted homes, fixing them up, renting them out, so people could have a place to live. Now I've seen the skyrocketing price of housing, especially in my community. Homes that were being sold on the first day on the market with seven or eight offers, $60,000 to $70,000 above that asking price, not from people in my community, but from the metro area leaving because of the high crime. And it created a lot of issues in my district. But what really got me concerned on this bill was the amendment you put on. Can you explain why a small group of people would get together wanting to help people get a place to live by buying blighted homes, putting thousands of dollars into them to fix them up so they can actually be used, renting them to people who can't, to give them housing if they end up with one too many homes, get $100,000 fine in your amendment? Can you please explain that?
Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Johnson. So that amendment came from discussions we had with multiple people who were very concerned about the only remedy being divestment from the property. And so in order to continue the disincentives to be in the market, because we want to continue to keep that market open for regular individuals and families, we listened, and people said a fine or a fee might be a much better approach to disincentivize corporations from entering the market in the first place. And so that's why that option is there.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Beckman-Finn, Representative Badgey, that's the fatal flaw in this bill. Because now you're disincentivizing people to fix up blighted homes, giving people an opportunity to rent them until they can afford to buy a home. This is exactly the wrong way to go. You're going to do more damage to the housing market by doing this than good.
All right. Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Agbaje, for recognizing the benefits of home ownership for everyone, and for I think trying to grapple seriously with that problem. I think that this approach is flawed in a number of ways. I think there are some really pretty potentially serious legal problems with creating restrictions and requiring people to divest of property at the requirement of the state. But the bigger, more fundamental problem I have with this approach is I think it's based on essentially a scarcity mindset, an idea that there is a fixed number of homes or a fixed number of houses that can ever exist in the state of Minnesota. And so we need to decide who are the right people to be able to buy them. And in fact, the opposite is true in terms of how we solve our housing problem. We need investment in the state of Minnesota to build new homes, to renovate or maintain new homes. And by telling, you know, the gentleman here that people like him cannot invest in Minnesota housing, or, it's theoretically possible, and I understand there might be some bad actors who are bringing capital from out of the state, but it's theoretically possible that some of those are going to offer or provide housing to Minnesotans in a good way, especially if we at the legislature have anything to say about the way in which they provide that housing. And so what we're doing, instead of making housing easier to build and provide, or encouraging people who want to invest in housing in our state to provide that housing, to build and maintain homes for people in Minnesota, we're telling investment to stay out of the state of Minnesota. And that's what this bill ultimately does. And so I think the goals are good, and a lot of other things we're doing in this space might be helpful. A lot of other things we're doing in this space are counterproductive. We're raising the costs of building housing in Minnesota compared to Wisconsin, for example. But this in particular, by saying we don't want investment in housing in our state, and to think that that's somehow going to help the housing situation in the state of Minnesota, I think that's the wrong approach.
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn and Representative Agbaje. Just really quickly, Representative Nisco, we have some really exciting bills to incentivize development of homes and build more homes in our communities, and I would love to hear your support for those bills, because we agree we need more homes. There are many opportunities I know from the Housing Committee to support new build of homes that people can afford. I have a couple questions. I am a renter. I rent in a district. I think the biggest challenge to my long-term involvement in this job will be getting priced out of my district. It's a very serious concern, actually. I got redistricted into a new district. It allowed me to run for office, but I'm just in that little corner. And in my little corner of the district, across the alleyway from me, is a house that has been sitting empty for 2 years that is investor-owned. Across the street from me is a house that an older gentleman died in and was purchased about a year ago. It was by a company that halfway remodeled it and then hasn't touched it for about 5 months. I was really hoping I could maybe buy that house, but no one either bought it or lived in it. So this is a real problem. And it's not a hypothetical. And I have some I have a couple quick questions and then a bigger question. So can you just, for the record, when I'm looking at paragraph B here, just define the distinction between what it means for a person versus an individual who is a natural person?
Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Finke. I think what we're going for in this bill is and if you can give me the line. Oh, I see. 1.9, is that what you're looking at?
Yeah, so it's like it includes any person, but it does not include. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Representative Agbaje.
Yes. Yes, so what we're going for is really just trying to show that this would be an incorporated, whether it's a group of people, a company, some other type of like grouping that is buying these homes. When it's an individual, we're trying to, because we actually heard from folks that they were worried about individuals being able to invest in property and buy property, we're trying to make a little bit of a distinction that if it's an individual, that this may not necessarily apply to them. The other thing I also wanted to note, too, is that this actually doesn't preclude anyone from purchasing and investing in multifamily homes. This bill does not touch multifamily homes, doesn't touch duplexes, triplexes, things like that. So people can still buy those properties, invest in them, and rent them out. What we're really trying to do is make that space to say that the people who are owning single-family homes should be actual people, actual families, that are going to live in them, be a part of the community, build up that community, build generational wealth in that community. So I hope that answers your question, Representative Finke.
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn and Representative Ekbaje. It doesn't start to answer that my question. So I have a community in my district where a single resident of that community purchased 25 of the single family homes and now rents them. And I'm curious if that person would be exempt from this bill. It's just an individual who decided to buy up most of the town, a significant portion of the single family homes in that community. And I'm curious if this bill covers them.
Representative Ekbaje.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. Thank you. So I think the original version of this bill would have covered them, but we just heard from a lot of people that were wanting to kind of protect like that one individual person. But you do bring up a good point because there's also another community I've heard of where one person owned like about 50 homes in that area. So that's something that we can continue to take back to just refine that definition a little bit to figure out where that line is when it's an individual. The issue is that most people at that level will end up at some point usually incorporating into an LLC and put all of those holdings under that. And so so it's still a fine point that we're figuring out where the exact lines are going to be.
Representative Finke.
Yeah, so I appreciate that. And I don't know what the answer is to that question. And I appreciate our a testifier who is trying to navigate that space because it is complicated. I'm a renter. I wouldn't be able to live in my district if I didn't rent. I also would like to become a homeowner, and I'm working towards that and trying to figure that out. I've had conversations with Habitat and other like ways to find routes to homeownership. It seems very difficult, and I think that there is a need for us to sort of recognize. I appreciated Representative Johnson saying that we need people to be able to rent, quote, until they're able to afford a home, and I don't think that that's the model anymore. We're not accumulating wealth. We don't have a generation of people who are renting until they buy a starter home, until they buy a bigger home. We're just being blocked from the first access point to homes. There's two homes available for sale right now in my entire district. They're not there. And they're not going to suddenly show up unless we do something that allows people who want to buy homes to be able to. I don't think that the reality of how the market has shifted is being reflected in a lot of the testimony that we're hearing in terms of who is kept out of access to a first or a affordable home that they can own. So I really appreciate you jumping into this because it is a really complicated issue and there are some very high profile cases and there are also just a lot of homes that people could live in if we wanted them to. And I just think as an industry, what we would rather see is, I mean, I was just talking about this with cows in environment, but it's also true of houses. We are taking the resources and we are putting them into the hands of fewer people who have more control over what people are trying to access. And that will always lead down the wrong path for our communities. So thank you for your bill. I appreciate the time to make these comments.
All right, Representative Scott.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And Representative Ekbaje, thanks for taking the amendment. I'm happy to work if there need to be nuances on the language of that amendment. I'm wondering on page 2.4 and following with all the exceptions you've got here, why the exemption for local, state, or federal government for owning, 500 houses?
Representative Ekbaje.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, that's to, we wanted to exempt public housing. So like the Section 9 housing that the government buys and they own those and their scatter site housing, which are usually single family homes. So that's just to make sure that the federal government is still able to be a player in this space. But I mean, public housing is also a little bit separate than the marketplace for individual homes. But that's the purpose of that.
Representative Scott.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Representative Ekbaje, you also have local and state, though. Words mean things, and I have concerns about that particular language, and I'm also wondering, Representative Ekbaje, why are you excluding nonprofits?
Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Scott. Similarly to those who are providing affordable housing, which is the purpose of sort of trying to open up the space for more individuals, oftentimes a lot of nonprofit players that are in the housing space, they're doing it to provide affordable housing. So, of course, we want to be able to maintain that option as well.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, you heard from the testifier, Mr. Rosar, talk about the fact that he is providing, he's not a nonprofit, but he is providing affordable housing below Section 8 numbers. And I've gotten contacted by constituents that are calling me saying, hey, this nonprofit just bought a couple of houses in our neighborhood, and they're from out of state. I've checked into this. The properties aren't being well kept. The tenants aren't being responsible with the property. What am I to do? So I'm just putting it out there that what this bill is doing is putting government and nonprofits, giving them an unfair advantage in the marketplace. So let's say in 2 years and a bunch of people have to divest their properties, the nonprofits and the local governments are going to be salivating, standing by, waiting for the fire sale to happen, because they're watching and they know that in 2 years this is going to happen. They're going to come in and grab those properties. So we're going to be back at the place. We've changed who the owner is, but we haven't changed the issue that you're trying to get at. And so I have a great concern when the government is telling the private market, you can't do this, but government and nonprofits can. And I also wanted to reference the testifier from Habitat for Humanity, and she cited a paper by the Federal Reserve in 2021. Well, there's an update to that. And what the update shows on investor-owned homes, the title of the article is Investor-Owned Homes, Ebb and Flow in Minneapolis-St. Paul Region. And they've said that this buying these single-family homes, that it's stabilized in the metropolitan area. Now, some areas of suburbs may be growing some, but it's really stabilized overall over the state. So my concern here is we're taking a hammer approach when a scalpel might be needed. If you want to get at not well-kept properties by big corporate, I think the Haven, whatever it was, issue, I think there's an attorney general lawsuit with that right now, then find out if there's another area of law that these people are breaking, which is what the attorney general is doing, to prevent, you know, negligent owners. But I received an email from a person, it wasn't my constituent, but they said, you know, in 2008, when the housing crisis hit the fan, he and his family, husband and wife, bought a single family home, their first one. Now they have about 150. And over the course of time, he's gathered investors, but they're supplying a service. There are people that want to rent. Owning isn't something that they necessarily want to do. And I would go out on a limb to say that the young people of today, a lot of them want to be able to pick up and move if they want to, and so they're renting. Yes, there are people that want to buy a home, and Representative Finke, I get that. But I don't think this is the approach to make that happen. I think this is going to be tied up in lawsuits. I think it's a terrible precedent to start. And I just wish there was, I don't know. We can't wave a magic wand. We didn't get here overnight in this home affordability issue. But doing this is not going to make the issue go away. It's just going to cause other players to come in and get those same properties. Maybe there will be a few people that will be able to afford a house that couldn't before under this, but by and large, you're not going to fix the problem. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I would request a roll call on the bill.
We're laying it over.
Oh, that's right. Sorry.
I'll just say, you know, as a member of this committee, that I think we do have to be careful in conflating nonprofits and the government to being on the same footing as businesses, because at the end of the day, legally, a nonprofit, their goal is to do things for the public good. And governments also are required to follow the things that are in our constitutions as far as what the benefits are for, as opposed to the benefit being to make more money. So there is a difference there. It makes sense to me that you would hold those things differently, because at the end of the day, you know, folks like Habitat for Humanity, their goal is to get more people housing for the public good, as opposed to making themselves wealthier. They legally can't make themselves wealthier. It's literally the definition of a nonprofit. So I know that tends to happen a lot in these spaces where we conflate them as being the same, and there are very important ways in which they are different. Closing comments, Representative Igbaje.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee, for your time and for the good discussion. You know, the purpose, again, of this bill is to provide another tool, another option in our home ownership struggles and crises that we're facing. We have a number of bills that will help with the increasing of building. We have a number of bills that help with the increasing of preservation. We also have a number of bills that will help go after landlords who aren't holding up their end of the bargain. But what we're also seeing is that we don't want to become like states that have allowed investor owners to flood their marketplaces. And there's nothing they can do now to go back. And so here in Minnesota, while we still have an opportunity to see the problem, we want to be able to take some type of action, and this is why this proposal is being brought forward. And so hopefully through that, we can provide an avenue for more people to be able to actually afford a home and be a member of their community. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, members, for the discussion. With that, I will lay over House File 685 as amended. You have time to get something to eat before public safety. For those of us who are on public safety, with that, we are adjourned.